Williams and his family head back to Mercer House. Siler goes to his office in Armstrong House. On the way out, he gets good news from his man in the corridor. Georgia has beaten Ole Miss 36-11. I ask Minerva if she wants to go have something to eat while we wait. She shakes her head and rummages in her shopping bag.
I got work to do here.
3 hours later, the jury sends word that it has reached a decision. Siler returns to the courtroom, clearly worried.
It's too soon, he says. The case has too many issues. They can't have reached a well-thought-out verdict yet. Maybe they just wanted to get it over with and go home.
Blanche Williams, too, has a sense of foreboding.
We hadn't sat down to dinner when they called us, she says. I made a caramel cake, that's Jim's favorite, and I was just getting it ready. Before we left the house, I saw James slip something into his sock. Maybe it was cigarettes. It makes me think James must feel he's not coming back home.
I sit down next to Minerva and notice almost at once that there is a thin trail of white powder on the floor in front of the jury box. There are also twigs and pieces of root in front of the judge's bench. Minerva is chewing slowly. The jury files into the jury box. She glares at them through her purple glasses. Upon the judge's order, Williams rises. The foreman hands a piece of paper to the clerk, who reads the verdict aloud.
We find the defendant guilty of murder.
Judge Oliver bangs his gavel.
The sentence is life imprisonment. That's mandatory.
The courtroom is silent. Williams calmly takes a sip of water from a paper cup. Then he walks across the floor and is escorted by the bailiffs through the door that leads to the tunnel that will take him to jail. I feel Minerva's hand on my arm. She's gazing straight ahead at a group of people milling around Spencer Lawton, and she's smiling.
What is it? I ask, wondering what she could be smiling about.
She points a finger at the district attorney, whose back is turned to us. He's gathering up papers and accepting the murmured congratulations of his staff, unaware of the footprint-sized smudge of chalky white powder on the tail of his suit jacket and the seat of his trousers.
"Did you put that white stuff on the DA's chair, Minerva?" I ask.
"You know I did,"
she says.
"What is it?"
"High John the Conqueror, a powerful root."
"But what good can it do now?"
"By getting where it got, that powder means Delia still be working on the DA," she says.
Delia was one of the names Minerva had called out in the graveyard.
"And she got him by the seat of his pants, too. She ain't done settling with him."
"What do you think'll happen?" I ask.
"You mean if Delia don't leave go?"
"Yes, if she hangs in there."
"Why, the DA's gonna have to turn Mr. Jim loose. It's just that simple. If I was the DA, I wouldn't be thinking about no celebration. Not with Delia hanging on he ass like she be. When she was living, she was bad. Dead, she's worse. And now, she about to raise all kind of hell."
"What happened to the other 8 dead women you called in the graveyard?"
"Didn't get no reply from the first 3. Delia was the 4th.
"And Dr. Buzzard? Is he involved?"
"He gave Delia the okay."
"Has he given you a number yet?"
Minerva laughs.
"Shit, no. He likes me poor. That way I gotta keep working and going to the flower garden to see him. That way he keep a hold on me."
Minerva picks up her shopping bag and gets ready to leave. The bag opens momentarily, and I catch a glimpse of what looks like a chicken foot. Minerva waves goodbye and slips into the crowded corridor. I make my way out of the courthouse, past Sonny Siler, who's standing in front of the television lights talking about an appeal. The courthouse flack sidles up, looking slyly amused as usual.
"With good behavior," he says, "Williams'll be out in 7 years."
"I'm told he might be out even sooner," I reply, "if a certain lady named Delia has anything to say about it."
"Who?"
The flack cups his ear.
"Delia." "Who is Delia?"
"You mean who was Delia," I say. "That's all I know about her. She's dead." Chapter 22. The Pod.
The posthumous powers of the late Delia, if she had any, were apparently not the sort that took effect immediately. This became clear the day after Jim Williams's conviction, when his lawyers went before Judge Oliver to ask for his release on bond and were curtly turned down. The judge did relent on one point, however. Williams would not be transferred right away to the much-feared state penitentiary at Reidsville. He could remain in Savannah at the Chatham County Jail, so that his lawyers could consult with him while they worked on his appeal, and that could take a year or more. This concession displeased the county commissioners, who voted to sue Williams for room and board while he remained at the county facility, $900 a month. The suit was dropped when the county attorney advised the commissioners it would not stand up in court. In the absence of its master, Mercer House assumed a ghostly air. The interior shutters of its great windows remained closed against the outside world. The gala parties were over. The elegant guests coming up the walk in evening clothes were only a memory now. But the hedges remained neatly clipped, the front lawn was mowed, and in the evenings, slits of lamplight shone through the louvered windows. In fact, Blanche Williams had moved into the house from her home in Gordon. She lived alone in the house, biding her time. She polished the silver and dusted the furniture, and every week she baked a fresh caramel cake in expectation of her son's return. The shop in the carriage house stayed open for business and was tended by Williams's shopkeeper, Barry Thomas. From time to time, Thomas could be seen standing in the street outside the shop, taking Polaroid pictures of a plantation desk or a chest of drawers being offloaded from a truck. Thomas would then deliver the photographs, together with catalogs of upcoming sales and auctions, to the jail a few blocks away, so that Williams could see his new purchases and make selections of what to buy or bid on next. It was common knowledge that Williams was running his antiques business from jail. He was aided in this effort by the lucky chance that there was a telephone in his cell. Ordinarily, an inmate serving a life sentence would not have ready access to a telephone. However, Williams's cell housed not only convicted criminals, but men who were still awaiting trial, and therefore had a need, and also the right, to talk to lawyers and family. The phone was set up to make outgoing calls only, and all the calls had to be collect. It would have been unthinkable, of course, for Williams to make business calls that began with an operator announcing bluntly, "I have a collect call from Jim Williams at the Chatham County Jail," but he got around that easily enough. He would make a collect call to Mercer House, and then his mother, or Barry Thomas, would accept the charges and use three-way calling to put his call through. By routing his calls through Mercer House, Williams stayed in touch with major figures in the world of antiques without ever having to reveal that he was calling from jail. He chatted with Geza von Habsburg at Christie's Auction House in Geneva and placed a bid for a pair of Imperial Presentation Fabergé cufflinks made for a Russian Grand Duke. He spoke with the editor of Antiques Magazine about an article he had promised to write on the 18th-century portrait artist Henrietta Johnston. Williams followed up each call with a short note, dictated over the phone to Mercer House, and typed on his engraved personal stationery. "It was good talking to you today. Hope to see you soon." The pretense that he was calling from the dignified confines of Mercer House was a difficult ruse for Williams to carry off, as I discovered the first time I spoke with him. A television set blared in the background,
and I could hear raucous shouts and an occasional high-pitched scream. Williams had been placed in a cell for homosexuals and the mentally unstable. He and his cellmates were segregated from the general jailhouse population for their own safety. The cell was known as the Pod. It was 20 feet by 20 feet and held 8 inmates. The mix of personalities confined in it created an unpredictable atmosphere.
"It all depends who's here at any given time," Williams explained. "Right now, there's one other white inmate and 5 garçons noirs. 3 of the 5 noirs play cards all day, but whenever there's any music on TV, they get up and dance and sing at the top of their lungs. That happens a lot, because the TV's on from 8 in the morning till 2 or 3 at night, with the volume turned up to scorch. I wear earplugs, and over that I clamp earphones so I can listen to tapes. But the noise from the TV cuts right through, and when they get to singing and stomping, I can barely hear my own music. I dread it when Soul Train comes on. The other 2 noirs are a pair of long-lost lovers who were reunited in here last week. There was much wailing and carrying on when they recognized each other. Accusations of betrayal, declarations of love and forgiveness, weeping, laughing, screeching, it went on for hours. As we speak, they're braiding each other's hair into cornrows. Pretty soon they'll be into face-slapping, and then they'll probably have sex. The white inmate is a little weak in the head. They put him in here this morning, and he's been rubbing the walls and preaching out loud ever since. We can't make him stop. It's a zoo. Things usually quiet down at feeding time, though. The menu usually consists of stale peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or a small slice of rancid meat. It's completely inedible, of course, but my cellmates don't know it, and it calms them down for a while. That's when I make my phone calls. At other times, if I need to, I can usually bribe them into shutting up with cigarettes and candy bars I buy from the commissary cart. Williams discouraged his friends from coming to see him at the jail. The visitor's room is a long, narrow hall with a row of stools facing plate-glass windows, he said. Whole families come to see their criminal loved ones. Babies are crying, everybody is shouting to be heard, and nobody can hear anything. It's bedlam. Williams clearly preferred not to be seen in such humbling circumstances. The telephone suited his purposes far better. He generally made his social calls in the evenings. There were no ice cubes clinking in his glass, but he was allowed to smoke his cigarillos, and I could hear him puffing on them as he spoke. "We've had a little excitement in here," he told me one night in mid-November. "We have a new cellmate who crawls around on his hands and knees and barks like a dog all day. Once in a while he lifts his leg and pees on the wall. We've complained, but nobody does anything about it. Yesterday afternoon, while the man was asleep, I bribed the others into turning down the TV and being quiet so I could make a few quick business calls. I was in the middle of a conversation with an important art dealer in London about a painting I was offering for sale when the new inmate woke up and started barking. I kept right on talking. 'Oh, that's my Russian wolfhound,' I said. But then the barking moved up an octave and turned into yapping. 'What's that one?' the dealer asked. 'A Shar Pei?' 'No, no,' I said. 'That's a Yorkie.' And then I cupped my hand half over the phone and shouted, 'Won't someone please put the dogs out in the garden?' At that point, I nodded at my other cellmates, and they tackled the madman and clapped their hands over his mouth. The dealer and I went on politely discussing the niceties of English landscape tradition while my cellmates scuffled at my feet. There were grunts and muffled strangulation noises. I don't know what the dealer thought, but in the end, he bought the painting." Although Williams spoke with his customary self-assurance, he made no attempt in our conversations to conceal the grimness of his existence. He had no visual contact with the outside world. The cell's 6 narrow windows were fitted with a muddy brown translucent glass, and the lights inside the cell stayed on 24 hours a day.
Williams said he couldn't eat the food and lived mostly on peanuts and candy bought from the commissary. A hard bump had appeared on his forehead, and there was a ringing in his ears and a rash on his arms and back. When the rash worsened, he went to the doctor and found 5 other inmates in the waiting room with the same rash. "Neither the blankets nor the mattresses are cleaned between inmates," he said, "and I have no confidence in the doctor here." Several crowns had fallen off Williams's molars, and there was no dentist at the jail. A trip to his own dentist could have been arranged, but he would have been forced to go in chains, shackled at the waist, so he dropped the matter. Williams continued to maintain his innocence. He was convinced that the jury in the second trial had simply rubber-stamped the first conviction. They had all been familiar with the case beforehand, because of its great notoriety, and they were under the impression that the first conviction had been reversed on a technicality. Williams was contemptuous of the jury, the witnesses, the district attorney, Judge Oliver, and the local newspapers, but he saved his sharpest scorn for his own lawyers. "I loathe them," he said. "They have meetings and conferences supposedly to discuss my appeal, but they accomplish nothing, and then send me bills for the time they've wasted. They are $5,000 and $10,000 me to death. The last thing they want to do is settle my case. It would cut off their supply of money. They've cost me $400,000 so far, and I've had to sell truckloads of valuable antiques out of my house to pay for them. Alistair Stair came down from Stair and Company in New York and bought a lacquered Queen Anne desk and a rare Charles II cabinet made in Charleston. He also bought the grandfather clock in the hall that Danny Hansford knocked over. I mean fine things. The most beautiful silver coffee urn I had ever seen. A pair of marble Foo lions that came out of the Imperial Palace in Peking during the Boxer Rebellion. They were my treasures. I sold the early American 4-poster bed out of my bedroom, the finest bed of its type I'd ever seen. I sold an Irish linen press that's featured in a book on Irish furniture by Desmond Guinness. Carpets, portraits. I sold a pair of Irish Chippendale chairs. One of them was the chair that I supposedly placed on Danny's trouser leg. Every penny from the sales goes into the bank and then straight out again, to lawyers, investigators, and expert witnesses. I have no choice. I have to do it. Money is ammunition, and as long as I have some, I'll use it. Spencer Lawton has an unlimited budget, full-time investigators, free use of state laboratories, but I'm forced to pay for every move my lawyers make to counter them. People think I'm rolling in money. They think I've lived a luxurious life with lots of servants and breakfast in bed, but that's all an illusion. I have a maid 3 times a week, but no cook. I make my own breakfast. I eat a sandwich for lunch and go out for supper, usually to the Days Inn coffee shop. But most people don't want to believe that. In Savannah, all you have to do is pay your bills and people will say you're rich. And how were the lawyers progressing with his appeal? He said. Whenever I call to talk to Sonny Siler, he's either in Athens at a football game, or on vacation, or just nowhere. I finally got him on the phone the other day, and I said, "Hey, Sonny, how's it going?" Sonny said, "Not well, Jim, not well at all." He sounded very down, so of course I assumed the worst. I said, "Why? What happened?" And Sonny said, "Jesus, Jim, don't you read the newspapers? The Dogs lost last Saturday." I told him, "Sonny, let's get one thing straight. The only game I'm interested in is the one I'm playing." In fact, no progress could be made with Williams's appeal until the trial transcript had been typed by the court stenographer. The trial had been long and involved, and the transcript would run 1,500 pages. It would take months to complete. Meanwhile, Williams remained optimistic. "I will get out of here," he said. "The Georgia Supreme Court will reverse my conviction, and when I get out, I will see that Spencer Lawton is charged with prosecutorial misconduct, suborning perjury, and denying me my civil rights.
How do you propose to do all that? I asked.
The same way I restore houses, said Williams. Step by step, inch by inch. I learned an invaluable lesson from my old mentor, Dr. L.C. Lindsay. Did I ever tell you about him? Dr. Lindsay was a college professor who restored and lived in one of Georgia's great houses, Westover. It was built in Milledgeville in 1822 in the grand style. It had spiral stairs and a pair of white double-height columns on each side of the front entrance. Dr. Lindsay told me that an old house will defeat you if you try to restore it all at once, from roof to windows, weatherboarding, jacking it up, central heating, wiring. You must think of doing one thing at a time. First you say to yourself, today I am going to think about leveling off the sills. And you get all the sills leveled. Then you turn your mind to the weatherboarding, and gradually you do all the weatherboarding. Then you consider the windows. Just one window at a time. That window right there. You ask yourself, what's wrong with that part of that window? You must do it in sections because that's the way it was built. And then suddenly you find the whole thing completed. Otherwise it will defeat you. That's how I will get out of here. Step by step. First, I will work on Sonny Seiler, get him moving on the appeal. Then I'll concentrate on the 7 justices of the state Supreme Court. Send them mental messages, just as I did after my first trial. Get them to see things my way. I heard Williams draw on his cigarillo. I pictured him tilting his head back and sending a stream of smoke ceilingward. One way or another, he said, I will get out. You can rely on that. And I'm not talking about suicide, although I've contemplated that option. My conviction will be reversed. You'll see. It may seem impossible to you, but let me point out something else. Something else I learned from Dr. Lindsay. One day he said, you know, robins move houses. Little birds with orange tummies can move a house. In fact, they tried to move Westover. I said, all right, I give up. How do they do it? And he said, they eat china berries, and then they drop the china berry seeds near the foundation of a house. A china berry tree grows there and uproots the house. And he was right. I've seen it happen. China berry trees grow very rapidly, and they will tear up the foundations of a house. That's how I intend to undo all the work Spencer Lawton has done to put me here. I will shake him to his foundations. It just might take a little time. Chapter 23. Lunch. Rather than arrive early for Blanche Williams's luncheon party, Millicent Moreland drove around Monterey Square several times. Then she moved on 2 blocks north and drove around Madison Square. She went back and forth, circling one square and then the other, taking her time, driving very slowly. Mrs. Moreland hardly knew Blanche Williams. She had met her briefly at Jim Williams's Christmas parties, and in the 8 months since Williams went to jail, she had made a point of calling Mrs. Williams every few weeks to see how she was getting on. After all, Mrs. Williams was nearly 80, and had moved into Mercer House all alone, without any family or friends nearby. Mrs. Williams appreciated the gesture, and told her son she wished she could thank Mrs. Moreland and many of his other friends for being so thoughtful. "Why not have them all to lunch?" he had suggested. The idea terrified Mrs. Williams, but her son reassured her. "You won't have to do anything at all," he said. "I'll take care of everything." From his jail cell, Jim Williams organized every detail of his mother's luncheon party. He drew up the guest list. He ordered stationery for the invitations and wrote out a sample for his mother to copy. He telephoned Lucille Wright, the cateress, and asked her to prepare a buffet of low country food. He selected the menu: shrimp, smoked ham, roast lamb, okra, squash, sweet potatoes, rice, cornbread, cookies and cakes, and told Mrs. Wright to plan for 20 guests. He later expanded the list to 45, and to serve the meal on the Duchess of Richmond's porcelain with Queen Alexandra's silverware, both of which she would find in the breakfront cabinet in the dining room. Williams hired his usual bartender and urged his mother, who didn't drink, to allow her guests at least half an hour for cocktails before serving lunch.
"That'll give them a chance to loosen up," he said. "We don't want them to be too glum and serious."
Finally, he told Barry Thomas to fill the house with fresh flowers on the morning of the party, and to be sure to go into the garden before the guests arrived and turn the fountain on. Mrs. Moreland was doing more than simply whiling away the time as she drove around the squares. She was peering into the parks in a way she had never done before, scrutinizing the people sitting on the benches, particularly the young men. She was surprised at herself for doing it, but she couldn't resist. Conflicting emotions were battling inside her today. It had all started with the headline in the morning paper: New Witnesses in Williams' Case. Two new witnesses had come forward, both of them favorable to Jim Williams. Such good news, and on the very day of Mrs. Williams's luncheon party. It was the first glimmer of hope for Jim Williams in nearly a year. Before she had even read the story, Mrs. Moreland rushed to the foot of the stairs and called up to her husband to tell him about it. Then she went back to the kitchen and sat down to read. Both of the new witnesses were young men, one 18, the other 27. They didn't know each other. They had come forward independently to say that Danny Hansford had approached them in the weeks before he died and tried to enlist them in schemes to kill or injure Jim Williams and then steal cash out of his house. Both of the young men said they had met Danny Hansford while hanging out in the Bull Street squares, hustling gay men. A flush of embarrassment came over Mrs. Moreland as she read, but she kept reading. One of the young witnesses had been enrolled in a drug rehabilitation program. The other had a string of convictions and was currently being held at the Chatham County Jail on auto theft charges. Both men said Hansford had wanted them to lure Williams into a sex scene as part of the plot. They had refused. Later, when Hansford himself was killed, one of the young men said he had thought to himself, "The dumbass tried to pull it off." The newspaper quoted Sonny Seiler saying he would use the affidavits of the two young men in his appeal. Mrs. Moreland was in turmoil. Happy as she was for her friend Jim Williams, she was nonetheless appalled. She had been unaware of the details of Williams's private life until his trials had so rudely awakened her, and she had finally come to terms with all of that, mainly by putting it out of her mind. But now this sordid business about the squares, and these new witnesses, who were they? Male prostitutes, burglars, thieves. Mrs. Moreland unburdened herself to her husband over breakfast. He attempted to put the new developments in perspective for her. "You wouldn't expect this Danny Hansford, this unsavory little punk, to discuss his murderous schemes with someone on the order of Mac Bell, would you? Or Reuben Clark?" The names Mr. Moreland mentioned were two of Savannah's most esteemed gentlemen, bank presidents both. Well, that did make some sense, Mrs. Moreland had to admit. But she was still dazed by what she had learned about the nefarious goings-on in the squares. And as she drove around them this sunny noontime in May, she did a little timid sleuthing. "Maybe that's one of them," she thought, casting her eyes on a shaggy-haired boy lounging casually on a bench in Madison Square. But then it crossed her mind that he could have been one of those art students from the Savannah College of Art and Design. How could anybody tell anymore? Mrs. Moreland shuddered and checked her watch. It was time to go to the party. but she had still not resolved her biggest dilemma. What to say to Mrs. Williams about the news? She could hardly exclaim, "Isn't it wonderful?" because a plot involving sodomy, murder, and theft could in no way be described as wonderful. There was nothing in those horrid little stories that was even slightly discussable at a polite luncheon party. She told her husband she thought she might just feign ignorance and pretend she hadn't read the newspaper at all that day. But he pointed out that a tactic like that could backfire. "It might just force Mrs. Williams to tell you all about it herself," he said. "Better to say something noncommittal like, 'We're all keeping our fingers crossed.'" And that is what she finally did. In fact, in one way or another, that was how all of the guests handled the matter. Mrs. Williams stood at the door of Mercer House in a light blue chiffon dress, accepting obliquely worded congratulations as her guests arrived.
"I feel the tide is turning," said Mrs. Gerard Haynes, giving Mrs. Williams a kiss on the cheek.
"Isn't this a sunny day?" said Lib Richardson. Alexander Yearley put it another way. "I expect it won't be long before Jim will be among us again." Mrs. Williams beamed.
"It's just like James said. Everything is going to work out just fine."
The double doors at the end of the center hall were open to the courtyard, giving a view all the way through the house to the opulent greenery of the courtyard garden. The rear of Mercer House was distinctly different from the Italianate facade in front. The back of the house had the look of an antebellum mansion. Tall columns supported a wide porch, shaded by dense swags of overgrown wisteria. Several of Mrs. Williams's guests came out to sit in the wicker chairs and look at the sunken garden, the grove of 10-foot-high banana plants, and the lily pond while they ate their lunch. Betty Cole Ashcraft sat beside Lila Mayhew. Mrs. Mayhew poked absently at her tomatoes and okra.
"I suppose we'll have another Christmas without Jim's lovely party," she said in a wistful voice.
"Good gracious, Lila," said Mrs. Ashcraft. "It's only May. So much can happen before Christmas. And anyway, it does look as though it isn't all over for Jim just yet."
"Jim always had his party the night before the debutante ball," Mrs. Mayhew went on. "That was his night, Friday. I can't remember what on earth we used to do in the days before Jim started having his parties. I've tried, but I can't recall. My memory is failing, you know."
"Well, never mind, Lila," said Mrs. Ashcraft. "Before you know it, Jim will be right back here giving his parties again. They'll just have to let him out now. I feel sure of it, what with all these ruffians popping up at long last and saying how they were getting ready to kill him. It's a wonder Jim didn't shoot them all. He would have been within his rights, you know."
Mrs. Mayhew put down her fork.
"Every year, Butine made a new dress for me to wear to Jim's party. Butine is my colored seamstress. I think sometimes she just redecorated an old dress so it looked new. I wouldn't have known the difference anyway. But last Christmas, when Jim was in jail, I said, 'Butine, let's don't bother this year. There won't be anything to do in Savannah the night before the cotillion anyhow.'"
"Now, Lila," Mrs. Ashcraft said gently.
"And do you know what Butine told me? She said, 'Miss Lila, there may not be anything for you folks to do that night, but that night, the night before the cotillion, that's the night of our debutante ball.'" "Lord in heaven," said Mrs. Ashcraft, "you don't mean it." "Yes, the colored girls. They have a debutante ball the night before cotillion. When Butine told me that, I thought, how lovely for them. And I knew right then and there that I would miss Jim Williams's Christmas party more than ever."
Mrs. Mayhew took a sip of her iced tea and gazed into the garden. As the two ladies lapsed into silence, I became aware of a conversation taking place sotto voce between a man and two women seated on the divan across from me. They were speaking like ventriloquists, barely moving their lips so as not to be overheard. When I tuned into what they were saying, I understood why.
It won't work?
One of the women asked the man.
Why not?
For several reasons, one of which is that those statements sound as if they were bought and paid for by Jim.
Would Jim do that?
Of course he would, said the man, and so would I in his position. Sonny Silas had both of the boys checked out by a private detective, Sam Weatherly, an ex-cop, good man. Sam says one of the boys may be telling the truth. The other one is poison. He has a reputation for selling testimony to the highest bidder.
Why can't Sonny just use the one who's telling the truth?
Because no jury is going to believe a street hustler. And anyway, what he has to say is irrelevant. Danny Hansford's motives are not the issue. He may have wanted to kill Jim, but there's no evidence he tried to do it. There's no evidence he even had a gun in his hand that night. No fingerprints, no gunpowder residue. The physical evidence is the issue. Now, if Jim could pay someone to discredit the physical evidence, that would be money well spent. Mrs. Williams came out onto the porch with a Polaroid camera in her hand.
All right now, she said. Everybody get ready to look pretty.
Her guests looked up from their plates, and Mrs. Williams snapped their picture. The camera made a whirring sound and churned out a black rectangle of film. Mrs. Williams went back inside and laid it on the sideboard with the others.
Later on, she said, I'm going to carry all these pictures over to James. I just know when he sees them he'll feel like he's been at the party too, I really do. Whenever something important happens, I take a picture to show him. I took him one of the wisteria when it blossomed over the front door, and he called and said, Thank you, Mother, now I can tell it's spring.
Faces were beginning to emerge in the photographs on the sideboard. There was Emma Kelly, sitting between Joe Odom and Mandy in the rear parlor. Upon arriving at the party, Emma had told Mrs. Williams that every day for the past 8 months she had played Whispering on the piano because she knew it was Jim's favorite song. Joe Odom remarked with an ironic smile that the way things seemed to be going lately, he and Jim might be trading places before long. Two people whose faces were just now coming into full color on the sideboard had caused other guests to stare in disbelief when they arrived at the party. Lee and Emma Adler.
Now I've seen everything, Catherine Gore had said when the Adlers appeared in the entrance hall.
The antagonism between Lee Adler and Jim Williams had gained a new dimension because of Adler's close association with Spencer Lawton. Lawton had recently announced he was running for re-election, and Adler had co-signed a $10,000 bank loan for his campaign. That check had made Adler responsible for more than two-thirds of all Lawton's campaign money. Adler made no effort to conceal his closeness to Lawton. On the contrary, he put a large re-elect Spencer Lawton poster on the fence in front of his house. Lawton's smiling face could be seen from the windows of Mercer House. If anything, Adler seemed to revel in Williams's predicament. He hosted a Lawton fundraising party, at which he stood up and read a telegram from a Lawton supporter who had been unable to attend. It turned out to be a joke telegram signed Jim Williams, Chatham County Jail, and it wished Lawton the very worst of bad luck. Adler's audience was not amused. It was tacky, said one guest. It made us all uncomfortable, especially Spencer Lawton, who was present. Meanwhile, Williams waged war against Lawton's re-election campaign from his jail cell, quietly channeling money to Lawton's opponent. A series of full-page anti-Lawton ads appeared in the Savannah newspaper bearing the headline, District Attorney Lawton Charged with Corruption and Misconduct. The ad reminded voters that in reversing the first Williams conviction, the Georgia Supreme Court had accused Lawton of corrupting the truth-seeking function of the trial process. The ads had been written and paid for by Jim Williams. For their part, the Adlers were as perplexed as everyone else as to why they had been invited to Mrs. Williams's lunch. After signing their names in the guest book,
Emma Adler wrote the word neighbors in parentheses, as if to make the point that their connection to the party was purely geographical. Mrs. Williams slipped the snapshot of the Adlers into the middle of the stack.
"James has his reasons, I'm sure," she said in her quiet way. "But, oh, that Lee Adler made me so mad one day. I would never tell James this. It's been about 3 months ago, I guess. One afternoon he came to make a courtesy call, and I thought, well, the man knows James is in a bind now, and he's come to have a look around. He thinks there won't be a thing on the walls and that all the furniture will be sold. So he came in, and he was very polite and everything, but I could see right through him. I knew it wasn't in him to be nice to James. He told me, 'Mrs. Williams, I saw Mr. So-and-so from Sotheby's in New York, and this, that, and the other, and if I could do anything for James, or if there's anything he wants to sell, just let me know.' Well, I'm going to tell you, right about that time I was fixing to blow up, but I didn't say a word. I was just as calm as I could be. And I said, 'I appreciate that very much, Mr. Adler, but even where he is now, James has got connections. He can call New York, he can call London, he can call Geneva.' I wasn't ugly to him or anything, but honey, inside I was boiling over, 'cause I knew he came to have a look around."
Lee Adler's attachment to Spencer Lawton was the very reason Jim Williams had told his mother to invite him. In Williams's view, Lee Adler controlled Spencer Lawton. "Leopold is the power behind the throne," he said. "He's like the vizier in a Turkish court, the man who stands behind a silken screen and whispers in the Sultan's ear. Lawton doesn't dare make a move without instructions from Leopold. That makes Leopold dangerous, particularly to me. I've given him plenty of reasons to hate me. I engineered throwing him off the board of the Telfair Museum when I was president, and I'm quite sure he pushed the DA into charging me with first-degree murder instead of involuntary manslaughter, though he denies it. He's dangerous, no question. But I understand him. I can talk his language if I have to. Honor among thieves, you know. It's never too late to hold out an olive branch. With my new witnesses, my case is going to break wide open. I can feel it. And when that happens, I don't want Leopold skulking around behind that silken screen making mischief." Williams clearly had some irons in the fire. An appeal in progress, possible new witnesses, and a candidate working to unseat Spencer Lawton. None seemed particularly promising, but if Williams was able to take comfort in them, what was the harm? It was unlikely that an invitation to a congenial luncheon party would convert Lee Adler to his cause. Still, Williams had summoned all the influence he could muster in the effort. The guileless charm of his mother, the delectation of Lucille Wright's cooking, the company of friends in common, and not least of all, the mysterious powers of Minerva. Minerva had come in from Beaufort and was dressed for the occasion in a maid's costume. For the first hour or so, she stood quietly in the dining room while the guests served themselves from the buffet. Later on, she circulated with a pitcher of iced tea. At one point, she poured two tall glasses for the Adlers, while munching on a root and fixing them with a penetrating stare through the purple lenses of her wire-rimmed glasses. Williams kept informed of the party's progress through periodic telephone calls during the course of the lunch. He reminded Barry Thomas to turn on the fountain, Thomas had forgotten, and he gave instructions to his mother and Lucille at each stage of the lunch. When the last of the guests had left, Mrs. Williams and Barry Thomas reported to Williams that the lunch had been a success. Mrs. Williams said she would be leaving shortly to bring the snapshots over to the jail so he could see for himself. After she hung up, she lingered at the desk for a moment. The morning's paper lay on the desk in front of her.
"Barry," she said.
Barry Thomas turned back at the doorway. "Yes, Mrs. Williams?" Mrs. Williams paused uncertainly. She glanced down at the paper and the story about the new witnesses.
I've been wondering," she said. All these things they've been saying about James and that Hansford boy, and now these other boys.
Mrs. Williams gestured at the paper.
I try not to pay any mind, but I don't know. Seems like I remember hearing people say the same thing about King James of England. You know, the King James that had them to write the King James Bible? Do you know if that's true? Have you ever heard anybody say that about King James?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I have, said Thomas. King James did have his favorites among the men at court, if that's what you mean. He had his special friends. I think he had several. The hint of a smile appeared at the corners of Mrs. Williams's mouth.
Well, she said softly. All right, then.
Chapter 24 Black Minuet. In mid-August, despite the statements made by Jim Williams's new witnesses, Judge Oliver denied Williams's motion for a new trial. Sonny Seiler promptly announced he would take the appeal to the next level, the Georgia Supreme Court. A few weeks later, Spencer Lawton won re-election as district attorney, ensuring that he would be in a position to fight the appeal every step of the way. When the bad news reached Williams, he picked up the telephone and called Christie's in Geneva to place a bid on a Fabergé cigarette case that had once belonged to Edward VII. It cost me $15,000, which I can ill afford, he said, but it makes me feel better. I'm the only person in the world who's ever bought Fabergé from a jail cell. Increasingly, Williams used little tricks to convince himself and others that he was not really in jail. He continued routing his phone calls through Mercer House and dictating letters that were typed at home on his engraved stationery. He sent several such letters to newspapers and magazines. One was published in Architectural Digest. It was a note praising the magazine for having run an article by the New York socialite Brooke Astor. Delightful, Williams's note read. Brooke Astor has given us a delicious treat by recounting her early experiences with formal dining. Her recollections will serve as a lasting guide in the art of living well. My best wishes to our hostess. James A. Williams, Savannah, Georgia. Williams would not submit to the notion that he was in jail. It's a matter of survival, he said. I hypnotize myself so that, in my own mind at least, I am not here. Wherever Jim Williams's mind had taken him, it was clear by early fall that his body would still be in jail at Christmas time. Once again, there would be a gap in the social calendar on the night before the cotillion ball, the night formerly reserved for his Christmas party. I recalled Lila Mayhew's lament back in May that she would have nothing to do that night. I also remembered what her black seamstress had told her, that the night of Jim Williams's party was the night the blacks had their debutante ball. The more I thought about it, the more I began to feel the urge, as an observer of the local scene, to know more about the black debutante ball and, if possible, to be invited to it. Savannah's blacks had been presenting debutantes at formal balls for nearly 40 years. The ball was sponsored by the graduate chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha, a black fraternity at Savannah State College. Nationally, Alpha Phi Alpha was the oldest black college fraternity in the country, having been founded at Cornell at the turn of the century. The fraternity was intended to be more than just an undergraduate social club, as its slogan, Bigger and Better Negro Business, suggested. In fact, the graduate chapter in Savannah, with 65 members, was more active than the undergraduate chapter, which had 15. The graduate alphas were representative of the upper level of Savannah's black community. Their membership included teachers, school principals, doctors, ministers, owners of small businesses, and lawyers. Notably absent were bankers, partners of the city's most influential law firms, directors of big corporations, and people with inherited wealth. The Alphas, unlike the members of the Cotillion, did not belong to the Oglethorpe Club, the Golf Club, or the Yacht Club. One of Savannah's three black city councilmen was an Alpha, but it couldn't be said that the Alphas, or the black community as a whole, were part of Savannah's power structure. The annual activities of the Alpha graduate chapter included a voter registration drive, a dance to raise money for scholarships, and a series of social events leading up to the debutante ball. The debutante ball had been the brainchild of Dr. Henry Collier, a gynecologist and the first black doctor to perform surgery at Candler Hospital. Dr. Collier got the idea for the ball in the 1940s, when he heard that a group of black businessmen in Texas had sponsored a cotillion. He suggested to his fellow Alphas that they sponsor a similar ball in Savannah, and the Alphas agreed. Dr. Collier lived on Mills B. Lane Boulevard, several miles to the west of downtown. He had built his house in the 1950s, when no one would sell him property in the exclusive white enclave of Ardsley Park. It was a rambling brick structure that had been added on to over the years without any apparent plan. A modest front door opened on a double-height entrance foyer, with a grand circular stairway and a bubbling two-tiered fountain in the center. A buoyant man in his late 60s, Dr. Collier greeted me warmly and ushered me into the family room off the kitchen, where we had coffee, while with great enthusiasm he told me about his brainchild, the debutante ball. "Our first ball was in 1945, he said. We presented 5 girls that year, and we set up a system that we've used ever since. The members of the fraternity nominate the girls, and then we check them out to make sure they meet our criteria. The girls have to be of good moral character. That's most important. They have to have finished high school and be matriculated in a school of higher learning. We interview their neighbors, their high school teachers, and people in their church. For a girl to be disqualified, somebody has to have definite knowledge of misconduct, that she has left home, or that she frequents lounges or nightclubs, or has been in trouble with the police. If a girl has had an abortion, for instance, that would rule her out. Once the debutantes have been approved, we require that they attend what we call Charm Week, so that they will know how to be gracious and the like. The Alphabets take charge of that. That's what we call the wives of the Alphas, Alphabets. Dr. Collier opened a photo album of memorabilia from past debutante balls. This was our first ball, he said. We had it at the Coconut Grove, which was a black dance hall. In those years, of course, public facilities were segregated, so none of the hotels would rent their ballroom to us, and the newspapers acted as if we didn't exist. We got coverage in the black press only. That all changed with integration. In 1965, for the first time ever, we presented our debutantes in the ballroom of the old DeSoto Hotel, the same room where the Cotillion had its ball the very next night. About that time, too, the Savannah Morning News finally decided it could call blacks by the courtesy titles, Mr., Mrs., and Miss, and they began to publish the names of our debutantes. I wouldn't say we've reached absolute parity with the Cotillion yet, though. The society pages always report on the coming-out parties that precede the Cotillion Ball. The mother-daughter luncheons, the barbecues, the lawn parties, the oyster roasts, and what have you. But when we submit photographs from our coming-out parties, they don't use them. However, Dr. Collier waved his hand, in time that too will come. As Dr. Collier flipped through the pages of the photo album, year after year of debutantes flowed by. Midway through, around 1970, I noticed that a change in complexion had come over the girls. Almost all of the early debutantes had been light-skinned. Now there were darker faces, too. The change coincided with the emergence of black pride, and it seemed that the Alphas had responded by expanding the range of skin tones deemed acceptable for debutantes. Dr. Collier continued turning the pages.
You know, some people say our debutante ball is just a copy of the cotillion ball. Sure it is. But you know, in one way, our ball is better than the cotillion ball. And it tickles me every time. See this picture?
Dr. Collier pointed to a photograph of 15 debutantes in a procession, their left hands resting daintily on the raised right hand of their escorts.
Know what they're doing here? He asked. They're dancing the minuet. They don't do that at the cotillion.
Dr. Collier laughed a delighted, cackling laugh.
That's right, we have 'em dance the minuet.
How did you happen to choose the minuet? I asked. Dr. Collier threw up his hands and laughed.
I don't know. I think we must have seen it in the movies. We do it very properly, too. We hire a string quartet to play the minuet from Mozart's Don Giovanni. And let me tell you, it's quite a spectacle. I'd like you to come as my guest. Then you'll see.
Ooh, child, Chablis cooed when I told her I was going to the black debutante ball. Take me with you as your date, honey.
I would have been hard-pressed to imagine a more demented faux pas than to appear at the ball with a black drag queen on my arm. I was hoping to be as inconspicuous as possible, and had already decided to go alone.
Sorry, Chablis, I said. I'm afraid not.
Chablis saw nothing at all outlandish in the idea of accompanying me to the ball.
I promise I won't embarrass you, baby, she pleaded. I won't cuss or dance dirty or shake my butt. I won't do any of that shit. I promise I will be the Lady Chablis all night long, just for you. Oh, I've never been to a real ball. Take me, take me, take me.
It's out of the question, I said. Chablis pouted.
I know what you're thinking.
You're thinking I'm not good enough to clientele with them fancy-ass black folks.
I hadn't even thought about that part, I said. But now that you mention it, the debutantes are all rather proper young ladies from what I've been told.
Oh?
Chablis looked at me archly.
And what does that mean, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, for one thing, I said, none of them has ever been caught shoplifting.
Then they must be real good at it, honey, or else they don't know what shopping's all about. I am serious. I can't believe you're trying to tell me that out of 25 bitches, not one of them has ever stolen a bra or a pair of pantyhose, 'cause I will not fall for that shit. All right, now, tell me what else is so proper about them.
They're all enrolled in college, I said.
Uh-huh.
Chablis studied her fingernails.
They do volunteer work for the community.
Uh-huh.
They go to church regularly and are known to be women of good character.
Mm-hmm.
None of them has ever been seen hanging out in bars or lounges.
Child, you are beginning to work my nerves. Next you're going to be telling me they've all had their pussies checked out and they're virgins.
All I know, Chablis, is that they have spotless reputations. That much has been checked out. And not one of them has ever been known to be guilty of misconduct.
Chablis shot me a sideways look.
Are you sure these girls are black?
Of course.
Then all I can say is they must be real ugly.
No, Chablis, they're pretty good-looking, actually.
Well, maybe. But any time I want to see a bunch of stuck-up nuns parade around in white dresses, I can take my ass to church. I don't need to go to no ball to see that. So you can forget about asking me to be your date, honey, 'cause I ain't going.
Well, I said, I guess that settles that.
The 25 debutantes had been culled from an original group of 50 nominees. Some of the nominees had declined the offer for lack of interest, or because they couldn't afford the $800 that being a debutante would cost, including the entrance fee, the price of a gown, the expense of hosting a social event, and incidentals. The prospective debutantes were invited to a meeting at the Quality Inn, where they were welcomed by members of the Alphabet Debutante Committee and told what lay in store for them in the months preceding the ball. They would be expected to perform 10 hours of community service, or write a 3-page